way on the other. A man dressed not unlike Hoppy, but without a cap and with a napkin draped across his arm, said good morning and showed us to a small table. He asked Hoppy if it was true that the light heavy whom he was to fight that night had a total of 27 fights with 17 knockouts to his credit. A real brawler. Hoppy said you couldn't believe everything you heard, especially in a railway dining car. That it was the first he'd heard of it. Then he shrugged his shoulders and grinned.
"First he's got to catch me, man."
He asked him about something called odds, and the man said 2-1 on the big bloke. Hoppy laughed and gave the man 10 bob, and the man wrote something in a small book. The man left and soon returned with toast and 2 huge plates of bacon and eggs and sausages and tomato, just the way Hoppy had said it would happen. I decided that when I grew up, the railways were most definitely for me.
"Are you frightened about tonight?" I asked Hoppy.
Although I couldn't imagine him being frightened of anything, I wanted him to know I was on his side. He had told me how it was with a light heavy, and it was obvious the man he was going to fight was to him just as big as the judge was to me. Hoppy looked at me for a moment and then washed the sausage he was chewing down with a gulp of coffee.
"It's good to be a little frightened. It's good to respect your opponent. It keeps you sharp. In the fight game, the head rules the heart. But in the end, the heart is the boss," he said, tapping his heart with the handle of his fork.
I noticed he held his fork in the wrong hand, and he later explained, "A left-handed fighter is called a southpaw."
"Being a southpaw helps when you're fighting a big gorilla like the guy tonight. Everything is coming at him the wrong way around. It cuts down his reach. You can get in closer. A straight left becomes a right jab, and that leaves him open for a left hook."
Hoppy might as well have been speaking Chinese, but it didn't matter. Like the feel of my hands in the gloves, the language felt right. A right cross, a left hook, a jab, an uppercut, a straight left. The words and the terms had a direction. They meant business. A set of words that could be turned into action.
"You work it like a piston. With me it's the right. You keep it coming all night into the face until you close his eye. Then he tries to defend what he can't see, and in goes the left. Pow, 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 all night, until the other eye starts to close. Then whammo, the left uppercut. In the southpaw, that's where the knockout lives."
"Do you think I can do it, Hoppy?"
I was desperate for his confidence in me.
"Piece of cake, PK. I really told you, man. You're a natural."
Hoppy's words were like seed pods with wings. They flew straight out of his mouth and into my head, where they germinated in the rich, fertile, receptive soil of my mind. The remainder of the morning was taken up with Hoppy writing up some books in the guard's van, where he had a bunk, table and wash basin, and a cupboard all to himself. Attached to a hook in the ceiling was a thing he called a speedball, for sharpening your punching. I was too short to reach it, but Hoppy punched it so fast he made it almost disappear. I was beginning to like the whole idea of this boxing business. Hoppy explained that at Havelot, the train had to take on antimony from the mines. There would be a 9-hour stop before the train left for Kap Mouden at 11 o'clock that night.
"No worries, little putty. You will be my guest at the fight, and then I will put you back on the train."
At lunch, my eyes nearly popped out of my head. We sat down at the same table as before, and the man who had been at breakfast, whose name turned out to be Gert, brought Hoppy a huge steak and me a little one.
"Compliments of the cook, Hoppy. The cook's got his whole week's pay down on an odds-on bet with 4 miners. He says it's rump steak, red in the middle, to make you a mean bugger," Gert laughed. "I reckon his wife is going to be the mean bugger if you don't win."
Hoppy squinted up at Gert.
"I get my head knocked in. The cook loses his money, but the man who keeps the book always wins. Hey, Gert?"
Gert looked indignant.
"Not always, Hoppy. I dropped a bundle when you lost to that blurry Roenick in Pretoria." "My heart bleeds for you, man. 15 fights, 14 wins, and you've always given my opponents the better odds. Christ, I've made you rich," Hoppy said,
and began to tuck into his steak. At breakfast, we had been in too early to see many other passengers. But at lunch, the dining compartment was full, and everyone was talking about the fight. Gert was moving from table to table, and in between serving was taking 10 shilling and pound notes from passengers and writing it down in his book. Hoppy looked up at me, the handle of his fork resting on the table with a piece of red meat spiked on the end.
"You're a betting man, PK."
I looked at him confused.
"What's a betting man, Hoppy?"
Hoppy laughed.
"Mostly a bloody fool, little booty."
Then he explained about betting. He signalled for Gert to come over.
"What odds will you give the next welterweight contender?"
he asked, pointing to me. Gert asked me how much I had.
1 shilling,
I said nervously.
10 to 1, Gert said. "That's the best I can do."
"Is this an emergency?"
I asked, fearful for Grandpa's shilling.
"At 10 to 1, I'll say so," Hoppy answered.
It took positively ages to get the safety pin inside my pocket loose and then to undo the duck Grandpa's shilling had been tied into. I handed Gert the shilling and he wrote something down again in his little book. Hoppy saw the anxiety on my face. It wasn't really my shilling and he knew it.
"Sometimes in life, doing what we shouldn't do is the emergency, PK," he said.
We arrived in Havelot at 2:30 on the dot. The heat of the day was at its most intense, and the vapoured light shimmered along the railway tracks. Hoppy said the temperature was 108 degrees, and tonight would be a sweat bath. There were lots of rails in what Hoppy called the shunting yards, and our train was moved off the main track into a siding.
"This is where I got my shunting ticket. When the ore comes in from Consolidated Murchison, and you got to put together a train in this kind of heat, I'm telling you, PK, you know you're alive, man,"
Hoppy said, pointing to a little shunting engine moving ore trucks around. We crossed the tracks and walked through the railway workshops, where they were working on a train. The men stopped and talked to Hoppy and wished him luck, and said they'd be there tonight. No way they were going to work overtime. The temperature inside the corrugated iron workshops seemed worse than outside, and most of the men wore only khaki shorts and boots, their bodies shining from grease and sweat. Hoppy called them grease monkeys, and said they were the salt of the earth. We arrived at the railway mess where Hoppy lived. We had a shower, and Hoppy opened a brown envelope which a mess servant brought to him when we arrived. He read the letter inside for a long time, and then, without a word, put it into the top drawer of the small dressing table in his room. He said it was best to keep my old clothes on because we would have another shower before the fight, and I could put a clean shirt and pants on then.
"We are going shopping, little booty, and then to the railway club to meet my seconds and have a good look over the big gorilla I'm fighting tonight. Bring your tackies, PK. I have an idea."
We set off with my tackies under my arm. The main street was only a few hundred yards from the mess, and there didn't seem to be too much happening. Every time a truck passed, it sent up a cloud of dust, and by the time we got to the shop Hoppy was looking for, I could taste the dust in my mouth and my eyes were smarting. It sure was hot. The shop we entered had written above the door, G. Patel and Son, General Merchants. On its veranda were bags of mealy meal and red beans and bundles of pickaxes, a complete plough, and a dozen 4-gallon tins of vacuum oil paraffin. Inside it was dark and hot, and there was a peculiar smell quite unlike anything I had previously experienced.
"It smells funny in here, Hoppy."
"It's coolie stuff they burn, men. It's called incense."
A young woman dressed in bright swirls of almost diaphanous cloth came out of the back of the shop. She was a mid-brown colour. Her straight black hair was parted in the middle, and a long plait hung over her shoulder, almost to her waist. Her eyes were large and dark and very beautiful. On the centre of her forehead was painted a red dot. Hoppy nudged me with his elbow.
"Give me your tackies, PK," he whispered.
I handed him the 2 brown canvas shoes, which had endured no more than 20 or so steps, and showed no sign of wear.
"Good afternoon, meneer. I can help you, please?"
she said to Hoppy. Hoppy did not return her greeting, and I could tell from the way he looked at her that she was somehow not equal. I thought only Kaffirs were not equal, so it came as quite a surprise that this beautiful lady was not also.
"Tackies! You got tackies?"
he demanded. The lady looked down at the tackies Hoppy was holding.
"Only white and black, not brown like this."
"You got a size for the boy?"
Hoppy said curtly. The lady leant over and looked at my feet and went to the other end of the counter. She brought a whole lot of tackies tied together in a bundle back with her. Shan picked a pair and handed them to Hoppy, who said,
"Try them on, Piquet. Make sure they fit, you hear?"
I slipped into the tackies, which were white, and looked splendid. They fitted perfectly.
"Tie the laces," Hoppy instructed.
"I can't, Hoppy. Mefrou didn't show me how."
The beautiful dark lady came around the counter, went down on her haunches, and started to tie the laces. Her coal-black hair was oiled, and the path down the center of her head was straight as an arrow. When she had finished tying the laces, she tested the front of the tackies with the ball of her thumb, pressing down on my toes. Then she looked up at me and smiled. I couldn't believe my own eyes. She had a diamond set in the middle of one tooth. She turned to look up at Hoppy.
"They fit good," she said.
Hoppy waited until she was back behind the counter.
"Okay, now we make a swap. Those tackies for these tackies."
He placed my old tackies in front of her. The lady stood looking at Harry Crown's tackies and then shook her head slowly.
"I cannot do this," she said quietly.
Hoppy leant his elbows on the counter so he was looking directly into her eyes. His back was straight, his jaw jutted out, and his head was held high. His whole body seemed to be threatening her. He allowed his silence to take effect, forcing her to speak again.
"These are not the same. Where did you buy these tackies?"
She picked up one and examined the sole. Then she turned towards the door behind the counter and said something in a strange language. In a few moments we were joined by a man with the same straight black hair and brown skin, but dressed in a shirt and pants just like everyone else. The lady handed the tacky to the man, speaking again in the strange language. He seemed much older than she, old enough to be her father. The man turned to Hoppy.
"We cannot make a change. This tacky is not the same. See, here is the brand, made in China."
He tapped the sole of the tacky with his forefinger. Then he walked over to the bundle on the counter and pulled one tacky loose from the pile.
"See, by golly, here's altogether another brand, and not from China. This time made in Japan. That is a different place, you see. This is a different tacky. You did not buy this tacky from Patel and Son. You must pay me 3 shilling.
Hoppy appeared not to have heard, and leaning over the counter, he tapped the man on the shoulder.
"Outside it says Patel and Son. This is your daughter, but where is your son, Patel?"
Patel's face lost its aggrieved look.
"My son is very, very clever, a very, very clever student who is studying at University of Bombay. Every month we are sending him money and he is sending us letters. Soon he will be returning BA and we will be most overjoyed on his returnings."
"Sixpence and these tuckies, Patel. I can't be fairer than that, man," Hoppy said emphatically.
Patel bent and twisted the tacky in his hand, a sour look appearing on his face.
1 shilling, he said suddenly.
6 pence, Hoppy said again.
Patel shook his head.
"Too much I am losing," he said.
Hoppy looked at him.
"Patel, this is my last and final offer, and only if the boy gets a bun seller. I'll give you another tiki. Take it or leave it, man."
Patel shook his head and clucked his tongue, and finally nodded. Hoppy took the 9 pence out of his pocket and put it on the counter. The beautiful lady held out a yellow sucker.
"Here is your bun seller," she said with a smile,
and I caught another glimpse of the diamond. I thanked her for the sucker, wondering what yellow tasted like. I still had one red one, and with this one I would have 2 for the fight tonight.
"Thank you, Hoppy,"
I said, looking down proudly at my new white tackies. I can tell you they looked good, and I could walk in them just like that.
"Better take them off, PK. If you're going to be in my corner tonight, we don't want you wearing dirty tackies, man,"
Hoppy said with a grin. I took the tackies off, and Hoppy tied the laces in a knot and hung them around my neck. I turned to thank Patel. He seemed to have become very excited and was pointing at Hoppy.
"Near Kid Lewis, I am very, very honored to meet you. All week, my golly, I am hearing about you and the fisticuffs business. This morning only, the telephone from my brother in Mika and my brother in Letziteli is ringing for placing a wager. My goodness gracious, now I am meeting the person myself."
Hoppy laughed.
Bet the ninepence you rooked out of me on me, and it will pay for your son's education, Patel.
No, no, we are doing much, much better. £10 we are wedging on Kid Louis.
Holy shit, £10. That's twice as much as I win if I win.
Patel proffered the ninepence he had been holding.
Please take it back, Mynheer Kid Louis. It will bring very, very bad luck if I am keeping this money.
Hoppy shrugged and pointed to me.
Give it to the next welterweight contender.
You are a boxer also.
I nodded gravely. In my head it seemed almost true. Patel dug into his pocket and produced a handful of change. He dropped the ninepence amongst the coins and selected a shilling.
Here is for you a shilling, he said fearfully.
Turning to Hoppy, he said,
Please, you must be fighting very, very hard tonight.
Hoppy grinned at him.
You don't know what you just did, Patel, but it is a very good omen.
Thank you, Mr. Patel, I said, my hand closing around the silver coin. Grandpa's change was safe again, and I must say it was a load off my mind. As we left the shop, Hoppy gave me a bump with his elbow.
You're a funny little bugger, PK. You don't call a bloody coolie mister. A coolie is not a kaffir because he's clever, and he will cheat you any time he can. But a coolie is still not a white man.
That lady had a diamond in her tooth, Hoppy.
Yeah, the bastards have got a lot of money, all right. You never see a poor chatter. Behind the shop is probably a big V8 Pontiac.
What if she swallows it?
What?
The diamond. If it comes loose or something.
Hoppy laughed.
They'd be sifting through cuck for days.
We stopped at a cafe, and Hoppy bought two bottles of red stuff. The old lady behind the counter took them out of an icebox, opened them, popped a sort of pipe only made of paper into the tops, and handed them to us. I watched to see how Hoppy did it, and then I did it too. Tiny bubbles ran up the bottle and went up my nose, and it tasted wonderful. On the side were the words, American Cream Soda. The stuff was like a raspberry sucker, only different. It was the first bottled soft drink I had ever tasted. We arrived at the railway club just before 5 o'clock. The club manager, who came onto the veranda to meet us, said the temperature was still in the high 90s, the rains were overdue, and there was already severe drought in the Kruger National Park at the far end of the Murchison Range. The club was cool, with polished red cement floors and large ceiling fans. The manager told us the boys from the mine had already arrived, and the railway boys, including Hoppy's seconds, were with them in the billiard room having a few beers. Hoppy took my hand, and we followed the manager into the billiard room. The room contained three large tables covered in green stuff, on which were lots of pretty coloured balls. Men with long sticks were knocking the balls together all over the place. In the far corner, some 20 or so men were seated at a long table covered in aeroplane cloth, on which were lots of brown bottles. They all stopped talking as we walked in. Two of them put down their glasses, rose from the table, and came towards us, smiling. Hoppy shook them by the hand and seemed very happy to see them. He turned to me and said,
PK, this is Nels and Bucky. Nels, Bucky, this is PK, the next welterweight contender.
Both men grinned and said hello, and I said hello back. We walked over to the group of men who had remained sitting around the long table. Bucky cleared his throat and put his hand on Hoppy's shoulder. He was a big man with a huge round tummy and a very red face, with a flat nose that appeared to have been broken several times. I noticed that Hoppy was staring at a man who was sitting at the table with a jug of beer in front of him. The man was looking straight back at Hoppy, and their eyes were locked together for a long time. Hoppy was still holding my hand, and although his grip didn't seem to increase, I could feel the sudden tension. At last the man grinned and dropped his eyes and reached out for his glass.
"Gentlemen," Bucky said, "this is Kid Louis, the next welterweight champion of the South African Railways."
The men at the side of the table nearest to us all cheered and whistled, and a man on the other side of the table stood up and pointed to the man Hoppy and I had been staring at.
"This is Jack Hammersmith. Stand up, Jack Hammer. Where's your manners, man?"
he grinned. The miners surrounding Jackhammer whistled and cheered, just as the railway men had done a moment before. Jackhammer rose slowly to his feet. He was a giant of a man with his head completely shaved. Hoppy's grip tightened around my fingers momentarily, and then relaxed again.
"This one big gorilla, PK," he said out of the corner of his mouth.
Jackhammer took a couple of steps towards us. His heavy eyebrows were like dark awnings above coal-black eyes. A growth of several days made a bluish stubble over his chin and gave him a permanently angry look. His nose was almost as flat as Bocky's, and one ear looked mashed. Hoppy stuck his hand out, but the big man didn't take it. The men all fell silent. Jackhammer Smith put his hands on his hips, and tilting his head back slightly, he looked down at Hoppy and me with eyes of anthracite and doom. Then he turned back to the miners.
"Which of the two midgets do I fight?"
The miners broke up and beat the surface of the table and whistled. Jackhammer Smith turned back to face us.
"Could Lewis, sir? Tell me, man. What's a boor fighter doing with a Kaffir name? Shit, man! You should be ashamed of yourself. Could Lewis? I don't usually fight kids, and I don't fight Kaffir booties, but tonight I'm going to make an exception."
He laughed.
"You the exception, railway man. Every time I hit you, you're gonna think a bloody train shunted into you."
He turned and grinned at the seated miners, who shouted and cheered again. Then he walked the two steps back to his chair, where he slumped down and took a deep drink from the jug of beer. Hoppy was breathing hard beside me, but quickly calmed down as the men turned to see his reaction to Jackhammer's taunts. He grinned and shrugged his shoulders.
"All I can say is, I'm lucky I'm not fighting your mouth, which is a super heavyweight."
Jackhammer exploded and sprayed beer all over the railway men who were seated opposite him.
"Come, PK, let's get going, man,"
Hoppy said, moving towards the door to the cheers, whistles, and claps of the railway men. Bocky and Nels followed quickly. Hoppy turned at the door.
"Keep him sober, gentlemen. I don't want people to think I beat him 'cause he was drunk."
Jackhammer Smith half rose in his chair, as if to come after us.
"You fucking midget, I'll kill you!" he shouted. "You done good," Bocky said. "It will take the bastard two rounds just to get over his anger."
He then told Hoppy to get some rest, that they'd pick us up at the mess at 7:15 to drive to the rugby field where the ring had been set up.
"People are coming from all over the district, and from Letsitela and Maika, and even as far as Hoedspruit and Zanin. I'm telling you, man, there's big money on this fight. Those miners like a bet." "No worries," Hoppy said. "See you at 7:15.
We walked the short distance to the railway mess. The sun had not yet set over the Murchison Range, and the day baked on, hot as ever.
"If it stays hot, then that changes the odds."
Hoppy squinted up into a sky the color of pewter, his hand cupped above his eyebrow.
"I think it's going to be a bastard of a night, PK. A real Havelot night. Hot as hell."
When we got to the mess, Hoppy told me his plan.
"First we have a shower, then we lie down, but here's the plan, PK. Every 10 minutes you bring me a mug of water. Even if I say no more, even if I beg you, you still bring me a glass every 10 minutes, you understand?"
"Yeah, Hoppy, I understand,"
I replied, pleased that I was playing a part in getting him ready. Hoppy took his railway timekeeper from one of the fob pockets of his blue serge waistcoat, hanging up behind the door.
"Every 10 minutes, you hear? And you make me drink it, okay, little booty?"
"I promise, Hoppy,"
I said solemnly, as he began to undress for his shower. The window of Hoppy's room was wide open, and a ceiling fan moved slowly above us. Hoppy lay on the bed wearing only an old pair of khaki shorts. I sat on the cool cement floor with my back against the wall, the big railway timekeeper in my hands. In almost no time at all, Hoppy's body was wet with perspiration, and after a while even the sheet was wet. Every 10 minutes, I went through to the bathroom and brought him a mug of water. After 5 mugfuls, Hoppy turned to me, still on the bed resting on his elbow.
"It's an old trick I read about in Ring magazine. Joe Lewis was fighting Jack Sharkey. Anyway, it was hot as hell, just like tonight. Joe's manager made him drink water all afternoon, just like us. To cut a long story short, by the 8th round, the fight was still pretty even. Then Sharky started to run out of steam in the tremendous heat. You see, PK, the fight was in the open, just like tonight, and these huge lights were burning down into the ring. The temperature was over 100 degrees. In a 15-round fight, a man can lose 2 pints of water just sweating, and if he can't get it back, I'm telling you, man, he's in big trouble. I don't know just how it works, but you can store water up just like a camel, sort of. That's what Joe did, and he's the heavyweight champion of the world now.
What did Mr. Jackhammer mean when he said you're a kaffir lover, Hoppy?
Ach, man, take no notice of that big gorilla, PK. He's just trying to put me off my stride for tonight. You see, Joe Lewis is a black man. Not a kaffir like our kaffirs. Black, yes, but not stupid and dirty and ignorant. He is what you call a negro, that's different, man. He's sort of a white man with a black skin. Black on the top, white underneath. But that big gorilla is too stupid to know the difference.
It was all very complicated. Beautiful ladies with skin like honey who were not as good as us, and black men who were white men underneath and as good as us. The world sure was a complicated place where people were concerned.
I've got a nanny just like Joe Lewis,
I said to Hoppy as I rose to get his 6th mug of water. Hoppy laughed.
In that case, I'm glad I'm not fighting your nanny tonight, PK.
After a while, Hoppy rose from the bed and went to a small dresser and returned with a mouth organ. For a while, we sat there, and he played Bura Musik on the mouth organ. He was very good, and the tappy country music seemed to cheer him up.
A mouth organ is a man's best friend, PK. You can slip it into your pocket, and when you're sad, it will make you happy. When you're happy, it can make you want to dance. If you have a mouth organ in your pocket, you'll never starve for company or a good meal. You should try it. It's a certain cure for loneliness.
Just then we heard the sound of a piece of steel being hit against another.
Time for your dinner, Hoppy said,
slipping on a pair of shoes without socks and putting on an old shirt. Dinner at the railway mess was pretty good. I had roast beef and mashed potatoes and beans and tinned peaches and custard. Hoppy had nothing except another glass of water. Other diners crowded round our table and wished Hoppy luck and joked a bit, and he introduced me to some of them as the next contender. They all told him they had their money on him and how Jackhammer Smith was weak down below. They almost all said things like,
"Box him, Hoppy. Stay away from him. Wear him out. They say he's carrying a lot of phleb. Go for the belly, man. You can hit him all night in the head, but his belly is his weakness."
When they had left, Hoppy said they were nice blokes, but if he listened to them, he'd be a dead man.
You know why he's called Jackhammer, PK?
What's a jackhammer, Hoppy?
A jackhammer is used in the mines to drill into rock. It weighs 130 pounds. 2 kaffirs work a jackhammer. One holds the end and the other the middle as they drill into the sides of a mine shaft. I'm telling you, it's bloody hard work for 2 big kaffirs. Well, Smith is called Jackhammer because if he wants, he can hold a jackhammer in place on his own, pushing against it with his stomach and holding it in both hands. What do you think that would do to his stomach muscles? I'm telling you, hitting that big gorilla in the solar plexus all night would be like fighting a brick wall.
I know, I said excitedly. You keep it coming all night into the face until you close his eye, then he tries to defend against what he can't see, and in goes the left, pow, 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 until the other eye starts to close, then whammo.
Hoppy rose from the table and looked down at me in surprise.
"Where did you hear that?" he exclaimed.
"You told me, Hoppy. It's right, isn't it? That's what you're going to do, isn't it?"
"Shh! You'll tell everyone my fight plan, PK. My, my, you're the clever one,"
he said as I followed him from the dining hall.
"You didn't say what happened to Jack Sharkey."
"Who?"
"In the heat when Joe Lewis fought him and drank all the water."
"Oh. Joe knocked him out. I forget what round."
Bocky and Nils picked us up on a 1-ton truck, which had South African Railways Gavelot painted on the door. Nils and I sat in the back, and Hoppy sat in the front with Bocky. In the back with me was a small suitcase Hoppy had packed with his boxing boots and red pants made of a lovely shiny material and a blue dressing gown. Hoppy was very proud of his gown, and he held it up to show me the Kid Lewis embroidered in running writing on the back.
"You know the lady in the cafe in Zanine?"
the young one.
The pretty one?
I asked, knowing all along whom he meant.
Yeah, she's really pretty, isn't she?
Well, she done this with her own hands.
Is she your noy? Are you going to marry her, Hoppy?
Ach, man. With the war and all that, who knows?
He had walked over to the dressing table and taken the brown envelope from the top drawer. He tapped the corner of the envelope into the palm of his open hand.
These are my call-up papers. They were waiting for me when we got in today. I have to go and fight in the war, PK. A man can't go asking someone to marry him and then go off to a war. That's not fair.
I was stunned. How could Hoppy be as nice as he was and fight for Adolf Hitler? If he had got his call-up papers, that must mean that Adolf Hitler had arrived and Hoppy would join the judge in the army that was going to march all the Roenicks, including me, into the sea.
Has Hitler arrived already?
I asked in a fearful voice.
No, thank God, Hoppy said absently. We're going to have to fight the bastard before he gets here.
He looked up and must have seen the distress on my face.
What's the matter, little buddy?
I told Hoppy about Hitler coming and marching all the Roenicks right over the Lubombo Mountains into the sea, and how happy all the Afrikaners would be because the Roenicks had killed 26,000 women and children with black water fever and dysentery. Hoppy came over to me, and kneeling down so that his head was almost the same height as my own, he clasped me to his chest.
You poor little bastard.
He held me tight and safe. Then he took me by the shoulders and held me at arm's length, looking me straight in the eyes.
I'm not going to say the English haven't got a lot to answer for, PK, because they have, but that's past history, man. You can't go feeding your hate on the past. It's not natural. Hitler is a bad, bad man, and we've got to go and fight him, so you can grow up and be welterweight champion of the world. But first we've got to go and fight the big gorilla who called me a kaffir lover. I tell you what, we'll use Jackhammer Smith as a warm-up for that bastard Hitler, okay by you?
We had a good laugh, and he told me to hurry up and put my tackies on, and he'd show me how to tie the laces like a fighter. The sudden sound of a motor horn outside made Hoppy jump up. He put the dressing gown in the suitcase with his other things.
Let's go, chimp! That's Bookie and Nils.
Wait a minute, Hoppy. I nearly forgot my suckers.
I hurriedly retrieved them from my suitcase. 6. The rugby field was on the edge of town, down a dusty road. By the time we arrived, I could taste the dust in my mouth. We parked the ute with all the other cars and trucks under a stand of large old blue gums, their palomino trunk shredded with strips of grey bark. In the centre of the football field, the men from the railway workshop had built a boxing ring that stood about 4 feet from the ground. The miners, who were responsible for the electrics, had rigged 2 huge lights on wire, which stretched from 4 poles, each one set into the ground some 10 feet from each corner of the ring. Huge tin shades were fitted over the lights, and in the gathering dusk the light spilled down so that it was like daylight in the ring. Hundreds of moths and flying insects spun and danced about the light, tiny planets orbiting erratically around 2 brilliant artificial suns. The stands, which were really a series of stepped or tiered benches, each about 20 feet long and 12 high, were arranged in a large circle around the ring. It meant everyone had a ringside seat. There looked to be about 2,000 men packing the stands, while underneath them, looking through the legs of the seated whites, the Africans stood or crouched, trying to get a view of the ring as best they could. Bucky and Nels led us to a large tent, on the side flaps of which was stenciled, Property of Murchison Consolidated Mines Limited. We entered to find Jackhammer Smith, his seconds and 4 other men, 3 of them ordinary size and 1 of them not much bigger than me. Hoppy whispered that they were the judges, and that
the dwarf is the referee.
I was fascinated by the tiny little man with the large bald head.
He may look silly, man, but take it from me, he knows his onions, Hoppy confided.
Jackhammer Smith had already changed into black shiny boxing shorts and soft black boxing boots. In the confines of the tent, lit by 2 hurricane lamps which cast a bluish light, he seemed bigger than ever. As we'd entered, he'd turned to talk to one of his seconds. My heart sank. Hoppy was right. I had seen his stomach muscles as he had turned, They looked like plaited rope, and his shoulders seemed to loom over the smaller men.
"This is one big son of a bitch, PK," Hoppy said. "Moses was still blubbing in the bulrushes the last time he weighed in as a light heavy."
He clipped open his small suitcase, and taking off his shorts and shirt, he quickly slipped on a jockstrap. He looked tough, tightly put together, good knotting around the shoulders and tapered to the waist, his legs slight but strong. He slipped on his shiny red shorts and sat down on the grass at the tent floor to put on his socks and boxing boots. Jackhammer Smith now stood in the opposite corner of the tent facing us, with the light behind him. He looked black and huge, and he kept banging his right fist into the palm of his left hand. It was like a metronome, a solid, regular smacking sound that seemed to fill the tent. The referee, who only came halfway up Jackhammer Smith's legs, called the two boxers together. I wondered if all dwarfs had such deep voices. He asked them if they wanted to glove up in the tent or in the ring.
"In the ring," Hoppy said quickly. "What's bloody wrong with right here, man?"
Jackhammer shot back.
"It's all part of the show, brother," Hoppy said with a grin. "Some of the folk have come a long way." "Yeah, man, to see a short fight. Putting on the bloody gloves is gonna take longer than a fucking fight." "Now, boys, take it easy."
The referee pointed to a fairly large cardboard box.
"Them's the gloves. 10-ounce Everlast from Solly Goldman's gym in Joburg. Specially sent, man," he said with obvious pride.
Bocky walked over to the box and took the two pairs of gloves out, and moving over to Smith's seconds, he offered both sets to them. They each took a pair, examined and kneaded them between their knees before making a choice. The gloves were shiny black. They caught the light from the hurricane lamp, and even empty they looked full of action. Bocky held the gloves out for Hoppy to inspect.
"Nice gloves. Not too light," he said softly.
"No worries."
Hoppy put a towel around his neck and then slipped into his dressing gown. Bocky slung the gloves around Hoppy's neck.
"Let's kick the dust," Hoppy said, moving towards the open tent flap.
Suddenly Jackhammer barked.
"What you say, Grunewald? Okay, boy, you winner takes all?"
Hoppy turned slowly to look at the big man.
"I wouldn't do that to you, Smith. What would you do for hospital expenses?"
He took my hand.
"That kid of yours is gonna be a fucking orphan by the time I'm through with you tonight, you nigger lover!"
Jackhammer yelled at Hoppy's departing back. Hoppy squeezed my hand and laughed softly.
"I reckon that was worth at least another 2 rounds, PK."
Pausing in the dark outside the tent, he took me by the shoulders.
"Never forget, PK. Sometimes, very occasionally, you do your best boxing with your mouth."
A small corridor intersected the stands on either side of the brilliantly lit ring by which the patrons and the fighters entered. It at once became obvious that one semicircle contained only miners, while the other only railwaymen, while smiling, excited African faces under the stands peered through the gaps between the legs of the whites. I had never been at a large gathering of people before, and the tension in the crowd was quite frightening. I held onto Nels's hand tightly as he took me to the top tier of a stand and handed me over into the care of Big Hetty. Big Hetty seemed to be the only lady at the fight. She was the cook of the railway mess, and Hoppy had introduced us earlier at dinner. Big Hetty had given me a second helping of peaches with custard, and Hoppy had said that I had better eat it even if I was full, because Big Hetty was a genuine heavyweight who could take on 2 drunken railway men with 1 arm behind her back. Big Hetty patted the place beside her.
"Come sit here, PK. You and me is in this together. If that big baboon hurts Kid Lewis, we'll go in and finish off the big bugger ourselves," she said, rocking with laughter.
Hoppy was seated on a small stool in the corner of the ring, with Bocky standing over him, bandaging his hands. When Jackhammer Smith entered, he didn't look up. Jackhammer paused in the middle of the ring and cocked 2 fingers in Hoppy's direction, much to the delight of the miners, who were cheering him like mad.
"Have we got a fight on our hands?"
Big Hetty said gleefully. Then she rose from her seat, and in a voice that carried right over the ring, she yelled,
"I'll give you 2 fingers, you big baboon! Right up the arse!"
It was almost totally dark. The sound of a woman's voice was unexpected, and for a split second the stands were hushed, and then both sides convulsed with laughter. Big Hetty sat down again. Reaching into a large basket at her side, she brought out a half jack of brandy. She popped the cork from the slim flat bottle and took a long swig, grimacing as she withdrew it from her lips, as though it was really nasty mooty.
"That'll fix the big ape," she said,
thumping the cork back into the half-jack with the flat of her hand. The fighters had both been gloved up, and while Hoppy remained seated on the tiny stool, Jackhammer Smit continued to stand, looking big and hard as a mountain. While my faith and my love was invested in my beloved friend, I'd been around long enough to know the realities of big versus small. Big, it seemed to me, always finished on top, and my heart was filled with fear for my newfound friend.
"My God, look at that sparrow fart!"
Big Hetty exclaimed, pointing at the tiny referee.
"How the devil is he going to keep them men apart?"
"Hoppy says he knows his onions, M'Frou Hetty," I ventured.
Jackhammer Smit began to shuffle around the ring, throwing imaginary punches. He seemed to be increasing in size by the minute, while Hoppy, seated on his stool, looked like a small frog crouched in the corner of the ring. Nels was putting Vaseline over Hoppy's eyebrows, while Bocky seemed to be giving him some last-minute instructions. The tiny referee said something, and the seconds left the ring, and the fighters moved to the center. The crowd grew suddenly still. Standing between the two men with his head thrown right back, the referee looked up at them and said something. They both nodded and touched gloves lightly, and then turned and walked back to their corners. The crowd began to cheer like mad. The referee held his hands up, turning slowly in a circle to hush the crowd, his head only just showing above the top rope of the ring. Soon a three-quarter moon on the wane would rise over the Murchison range, though as yet the night was matte black with only a sharp square of brilliant light etching out the ring with the three men in it. It was as though the two fighters and the dwarf stood alone, watched by an audience of a million stars. The referee addressed the stilled crowd, his surprisingly deep voice carrying easily to where we sat.
"Dames en heren, tonight we are witnessing the great biblical drama of David and Goliath."
He paused for his words to take effect.
"Weeping Jesus, Sparrow Fart's gonna give us a Bible lesson,"
Big Hetty hissed at no one in particular. She took a quick swig from the half-jack as the referee continued.
"Will history repeat itself? Will David once again defeat Goliath?"
The railwaymen went wild, and the miners hissed and booed. The referee held his hands up for silence.
"Or will Goliath have his revenge?"
The miners cheered like mad, and this time it was the railwaymen who booed and hissed. The little man held up his hands again, and the audience calmed down.
"Introducing in the blue corner, weighing 205 pounds and hailing from Murchison Consolidated Mines, the ex-light heavyweight champion of the Northern Transvaal, Jackhammer Smit. 22 fights, 11 knockouts, 11 losses on points. A fighter with an even Stevens record in the ring. Ladies and gentlemen, put your hands together for Jackhammer Smit."
The miners cheered and whistled.
"What's 11 losses on points mean, M'Frou Hetty?" I asked urgently.
"It means he's a pug, a one-punch Johnny, a slugger,"
she said, taking another swig and wiping the top of the bottle with the palm of her hand.
"It means he's no boxer."
The referee turned to indicate Hoppy, who raised his hands to acknowledge the crowd.
"In the red corner, weighing 145 pounds, from Chavalot Kid Lewis of the South African Railways, Northern Transvaal welterweight champion, and the recent losing contender for the Transvaal title. 15 fights, 14 wins, 8 knockouts, 1 loss."
He cleared his throat before continuing.
"Let me remind you that the fighter he narrowly lost to on points in Pretoria went on to win the South African title in Cape Town."
He raised his voice slightly.
"Let's hear it for the one and only Kid Lewis!"
It was our turn to cheer until the referee orchestrated us back to silence. Hoppy had once again calmly seated himself on the tiny stool, while Jackhammer Smit was snorting and throwing punches at an imaginary opponent, soon to become Hoppy.
"This is a 15-round contest. May the best man win."
The referee had already assumed the authority of the fight, and he didn't look small anymore. It was clear the crowd accepted him. He moved to the edge of the ring, where the light spilled sufficiently to show three men seated at a small table.
"Ready, judges?"
They nodded, and he turned to the two fighters.
"At the sound of the bell, come out fighting, gentlemen."
Out of the darkness, the bell sounded for round one. Hoppy jumped from the stool as Nels pulled it out of the ring, and Jackhammer Smut stormed towards him. In the oppressive heat, the air was as still as a dead man's breath, and the big boxer's torso was already glistening with sweat. I had earlier unwrapped my first sucker, as usual, licking the clear cellophane clean. It was the yellow one the beautiful Indian lady with the diamond in her tooth had given me, and the wrapper tasted vaguely of pineapple, only even sweeter than a real pineapple. Hoppy danced around the big man, and Jackhammer Smut let go two left jabs and a right uppercut, all of which missed Hoppy by a mile. He followed with a straight left, which Hoppy caught neatly in his glove as he was going away. Hoppy fainted to the right as Jackhammer tried to catch him with two left jabs. Then he stepped in under the last jab and peppered Jackhammer's face with a two-handed attack. Two left, then two stabbing rights to the head. The blows were lightning fast. Hoppy had moved out of reach by the time Jackhammer Smut could bring his gloves back into position in front of his face. Hoppy continued to backpedal most of the time, making Smut chase him around the ring. Occasionally he darted in with a flurry of blows to the head, and then danced out of range again. Jackhammer came doggedly after him, trying to get set for a big punch, but Hoppy was content to land a quick left and a right and then move quickly out of harm's way. The first round saw him land a dozen good punches, most of them just above Jackhammer's left eye, while the big man only managed a long straight left that caught Hoppy on the shoulder as the welterweight was moving away. It was clear that Jackhammer Smut was having trouble with the southpaw and was showing his frustration. The bell went for the end of the first round, and the fighters returned to their corners. This time, like Hoppy, Jackhammer sat down, breathing heavily. He drank deeply, straight from a bottle of water one of his seconds held up to his mouth. The other second sponged him, dried him, and smeared Vaseline above his left eye. Hoppy looked composed, breathing lightly. He drank from a bottle with a tiny bent pipe coming out of it, rinsing his mouth and spitting the water back into a bucket Bocky held for him. Nels was massaging his shoulders, and Hoppy was nodding his head at something Bocky was saying.
"Is Hoppy winning, Mfro Hetty?"
I asked anxiously.
"It's early times yet, PK. In the early rounds, the kid will be too fast for the big guy, but one thing's for sure. Hoppy's punches are too short to hurt Smut."
The bell went for round two. A round much the same as round one, except that Jackhammer Smut landed three punches to Hoppy's head, all of them glancing blows, but each time the miners went wild. After the second round, a red blotch began to appear above Jackhammer's left eye. The next three rounds saw Hoppy leading Smut all around the ring, making him throw punches that nearly always missed, and then darting in with a quick flurry of blows before bouncing back out of harm's way. The bell went for the sixth round, and Jackhammer shuffled to the center of the ring, his gloves rotating slowly in front of his chest. He was getting the hang of the southpaw, and was going to make Hoppy take the fight to where he stood, rooted to the center of the ring. Jackhammer dropped his gloves, leaving his head a clear target, knowing he could take anything Hoppy dished out. Hoppy was forced to move in close enough for Smut to hit him in the gut and around the kidneys. In this way, Hoppy had to take a couple of vicious blows to the body every time he moved in to hit the spot above Jackhammer's left eye. Jackhammer gave a grunt as he drove a left or a right into Hoppy's body, and the crowd responded as one man with an exclamation of pain. By the end of the sixth, Jackhammer's left eye was almost closed, but deep red welts showed on Hoppy's ribs where Jackhammer had caught him. Both men were breathing hard as they returned to their corners.
"It's not looking good for the kid. The big ape has found his mark, and he's going to wear him down with body punches. You could have fooled me. He got more brains than I would have given him credit for,"
Big Hetty said. She didn't show any emotion, appraising the progress of the fight as though she were simply an informed, though disinterested, bystander.
"Don't let him have brains, Mfro Hetty. Brains is one thing you've got to have to win," I said in anguish.
Big Hetty was fanning herself with a brightly coloured Chinese paper fan, the perspiration running down the sides of her face and neck.
"He hits awful hard, PK," she said absently.
The bell went for the seventh, and Jackhammer shuffled back to the center of the ring. The heat was plainly telling on him, and his gloves were held even lower than before. This left enough of his body exposed for Hoppy to hit him at long range, getting a lot more power behind his punches. The left eye was closed, and Hoppy was beginning to work on the right, jabbing straight left, right on the button every time. Near the end of the round, he attempted a right cross to Jackhammer's jaw, just as the big man had moved back slightly to throw a punch. Hoppy missed with the right and was thrown slightly off balance as Smith followed through with an uppercut that caught the smaller man under the heart. You could hear his grunt as the punch landed, and Hoppy's legs buckled under him as he toppled to the canvas.
Oh, shit! One Punch Johnny has found the punch! Goliath wins in 7!
Big Hetty said in dismay, as the miners went wild. The tiny referee was standing over Hoppy and yelling at Jackhammer Smith to get into a neutral corner. But the big man just stood there, his chest heaving, waiting for Hoppy to rise so that he could finish him off. The referee wouldn't start the count, and precious seconds passed as the big man stood belligerently over the fallen welterweight. Jackhammer's seconds were screaming at him to move away, and when finally he did, a good 30 seconds had passed. The referee started to put in the count. Hoppy rose onto one knee and waited until the count of 8 before rising and getting to his feet. The referee signaled for the fight to continue, and Jackhammer Smith lumbered across the ring to finish Hoppy off. The almost 40-second respite had been enough to stave off disaster, and Hoppy simply kept out of harm's way as Jackhammer, energy leaking out of him with every assault, kept charging at him like an angry bull. The bell went just as Hoppy landed a hard left uppercut to Jackhammer's eye when the big man tried another desperate charge.
Damn it, PK, that was lucky. Thank the Lord Jesus, Sparrow Fart knows the bloody rules. The kid was out for a 10 count for sure.
Big Hetty removed a dish towel that covered the basket and mopped her face and bosom.
Smith's just another stupid boor after all. All balls and no brains. Hoppy can thank his lucky stars for that.
In all the excitement, I had bitten the sucker clean off its stick and crunched it to bits, shortening its life by at least 30 minutes. I ran my tongue around the inside of my mouth, seeking the last of the pineapple-y taste. It could be a long time before another one came my way. Big Hetty took a thermos flask from the basket, and using the silver lid, which was shaped like a cup, poured it full of hot, sweet, milky coffee and handed it to me. Then she opened a large cake tin and handed me a huge slice of chocolate cake. My eyes nearly popped out on stalks. This was going to be a night to remember, all right. If Hoppy, beloved Hoppy, could just keep away from the big gorilla. The way he danced around the big man, seeming only to get out of the way of a punch at the last second, reminded me of how Grandpa Chook used to dodge when stones were thrown at him. I only hoped that Hoppy had the same survival instinct. For an instant I grew sad. In the end, even Grandpa Chook's highly developed sense of survival couldn't save him. The big gorilla finally got him. The 8th round saw another change in the fight. Jackhammer Smith had chased Hoppy too hard and too long. The gorilla's great strength had been sapped by the heat, and he was down to barely a shuffle, both eyes nearly closed. Hoppy was hitting him almost at will, and Jackhammer pulled the smaller man into a clinch whenever he could, causing the tiny referee to stand on the tips of his toes and pull at his massive arms, yelling, "Break!" at the top of his voice. The 9th and the 10th rounds were much of the same, but Hoppy didn't seem to have the punch to put Jackhammer away. Early in the 11th, Smith managed to get Hoppy into yet another clinch, leaning heavily on the smaller man. As the referee moved in to break them up, Jackhammer Smith stepped backwards into him, sending the tiny referee arse over tip to the floor. Still holding Hoppy, Smith headbutted him viciously. On the railway side of the ring, we saw the incident clearly, but all the miners like the ref saw was Hoppy's legs buckle and the welterweight crash to the floor as Jackhammer Smith broke out of the clinch. This time, Smith moved quickly to the neutral corner, and the referee, bouncing to his feet like a rubber ball, started to count Hoppy out. Pandemonium broke loose. The railwaymen, shouting, "Foul!" began to come down from the stands, shaking their fists. At the count of 6, the bell went for the end of the round, and Bocky and Nels rushed into the ring to help a dazed and wobbly Hoppy to his corner. A score of railwaymen had reached the ring and were shouting abuse at Jackhammer. The miners were yelling and coming down from their stands, and I'm telling you, the whole scene was a proper kerfuffle. Jackhammer sat in his corner, vomiting into a bucket, and Bocky and Nils were frantically trying to bring Hoppy round, holding a small bottle under his nose. I had begun to cry, and Big Hetty drew me into her bosom while hurling abuse at Jackhammer Smith.
"You bastard! You dirty bastard! Come into my kitchen tomorrow and I'll de-knacker you, you son of a bitch!"
she screamed. I could hear her heart going boom, 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 and the smell of brandy on her breath was overpowering. I can tell you I stopped crying quick smart. Her arm was pinning me to her heaving bosom so tightly that I was beginning to feel faint. Thank God she released me so she could stand up and shake her fist. Several fights had started around the base of the ring, and the judges' table had been overturned. The referee stood in the center of the ring, his hands raised, his head shining like a beacon. He didn't move, and this seemed to have a calming effect on the crowd. Others rushed in to stop the ringside brawling, pulling their mates away. Not until there was complete silence did the referee indicate that both fighters should come to the center of the ring. Hoppy, meanwhile, seemed fully recovered, while Jackhammer, huge chest still heaving and both eyes puffed up slits, looked a mess. The referee took Hoppy's arm and raised it as high as he was able.
"Ked Lewis on a foul in the 11th," he shouted.
The railwaymen went wild with excitement while the miners started to come down from their stands again.
"Shit, it's going to be one for one and all," Big Hetty said.
Hoppy jerked his arm away and started an animated argument with the ref, pointing his glove at the near-blind Jackhammer. Finally, the referee held his arms up for silence.
"The fight goes on," he shouted,
and both boxers moved back to their corners. The bell began to clang repeatedly, and in a short while the ringside fighting stopped, and the men, walking backwards, still shaking their fists at each other, returned to their seats.
"That Hoppy Groenewald is mad as a matex," Big Hetty declared. "He had the bloody fight won, and he wants to start all over again."
She wiped away a tear with the dishcloth.
"Jesus, PK, he has guts. That one is a real Irishman."
10 minutes passed before the bell went for round 12, by which time Hoppy was good as gold, and Jackhammer's seconds, in between his bouts of vomiting, had managed to half open his left eye. The closed lids of his right eye extended beyond his brows so that he was forced to hunt Hoppy with only half a left eye. It was no contest. Hoppy darted in and slammed two quick left jabs straight into the half-open eye and closed it again. The rest of the round was a shambles, with Jackhammer simply covering his face with his gloves and Hoppy boring into his body. The years behind a Jackhammer were counting, and Jackhammer Smith simply leant on the ropes and took everything Hoppy could throw at him. He grunted as Hoppy ripped a blow under his heart, and Jackhammer opened his gloves in a reflex action. Hoppy saw the opening and moved in with a perfect left uppercut that landed flush on Jackhammer's jaw. The big man sank to the canvas just as the bell went for the end of the round. Hoppy's shoulders sagged as he walked back to his corner. It was clear to us all that he was exhausted, fighting more by instinct than by conscious will. Jackhammer's seconds climbed into the ring and helped him to his feet, leading the almost blind fighter to his corner.
"Sweet Jesus, they got to throw in the towel," Big Hetty said in elation. "Hoppy's got it on a TKO.
My heart was pounding fiercely. It seemed certain now that small could beat big. All it took was brains and skill and heart and a plan, a perfect plan. But we were wrong. The bell went for the 13th, and Jackhammer Smith rose slowly to his feet, half dragging himself into the center of the ring. Hoppy, too exhausted to gain much from the rest between rounds, was also clearly spent. He hadn't expected Jackhammer Smith to come out for the 13th, and his extreme fatigue sapped his will to continue. It was as though both moved towards the other in a dream. Hoppy landed a straight left into Jackhammer's face, starting his nose bleeding again. He followed this with several more blows to the head, but his punches lacked strength, and Jackhammer, unable to reply, his pride keeping him on his feet, absorbed the extra punishment. He managed to get Hoppy into a clinch, leaning hard on the smaller man, in an attempt to sap what strength was left. When the referee shouted at the two men to break, he pushed at Hoppy and at the same time hit him with a round-arm blow to the head that carried absolutely no authority as a punch. To our consternation and the tremendous surprise of the miners, Hoppy went down. He rose instantly to one knee, his right hand on the deck to steady him. Jackhammer, sensing from the roar of the crowd that his opponent was down, dropped his gloves and moved forward. Through his bloodied fog, he may not have seen the punch coming at him. The left from Hoppy came all the way from the deck with the full weight of his body to drive the blow straight to the point of Jackhammer Smith's jaw. The giant wobbled for a split second, then crashed unconscious to the canvas.
"Timber!"
Big Hetty screamed as the crowd went berserk. I had just witnessed the final move in a perfectly wrought plan, where small defeats big. First with the head,